This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Paul Tripp. We're going to be discussing his UNS review articles, including one on the case for a Green New Right. Paul, it's great having you on.
Hey, Robert. It's great to be here.
Paul, to start things off, can you give us some brief background information?
Sure. I've got a political science degree. I started out politically as kind of a libertarian, having problems with both the left and the right, but agreeing with both sides on some things. So I tended to, try to look at the facts from both sides and make my conclusions from there. I've kind of slowly drifted up the right side of the political spectrum over the last few years in the era of Trump. But one of the big reasons for that is actually the environment, and that I actually believe that there are a lot of significant environmental problems that humanity is facing right now. But I don't believe that the left has the proper solutions to fix those problems, and in fact, I think a lot of the things that they support actually make them worse.
So this UNS review article, it's titled The Green New Right. Why do you think the left's handling of environmental issues has been inept?
Well, for one thing, they focus on the wrong problem. Pretty much their entire focus is on carbon emissions causing climate change. Which, there have been a lot of overblown predictions of that, we'd all be underwater from sea level rise by now and such, that we'd be seeing worse warming than we're actually seeing. So I think they've kind of just played their hand too heavily on that issue while ignoring bigger problems like deforestation and wildlife loss and ocean trash and groundwater pollution and loss and soil erosion and things like that. There's a whole lot more to our environment than just carbon emissions, and a lot of those issues are much bigger problems. And I think part of the reason that they focus so much on carbon emissions over the rest of those problems is that it is the one issue that the West is a little bit worse on than the rest of the world, in a lot of ways, at least in terms of how much each individual in the West contributes to that problem. But when you look at, like, ocean trash, Europe and the United States together are responsible for less than 1% of ocean trash, whereas China and India are responsible for a solid majority of ocean trash. Africa and South America both are responsible for more ocean trash per person.
A lot of it comes from, specifically from these river deltas. So, I forget the names of the specific rivers, but the two major ones in China, the Ganges.
Like the Yellow River.
Yeah, the Yellow River in China, the Ganges in India. I think there's another river, maybe it's the Niger River in Africa, too.
Yeah, and I mean, we have, major rivers in the U.S. We've got the Mississippi, which is huge. I forget the one up in New England, but, we have quite a few river valleys like that here as well. But we have much stricter restrictions as far as, pollution and dumping trash into them, and we do a much better job of enforcing those laws. So we don't really have, the same problem with contributing to that problem that a lot of the rest of the world does. We actually do a lot more to take care of our ecosystem than a lot of the rest of the world. It's really just carbon emissions that we're worse at, and the evidence that that's a major problem is a lot more questionable than a lot of people on the left want to admit. So then you look at, like, deforestation. The biggest countries for deforestation right now are places like Brazil. We're seeing the most rapid rate of deforestation in South America and in Africa. The U.S. and Europe actually have much higher ratios of forest to farmland than most of the rest of the world, whereas China and India have some of the lowest ratios of forest to farmland in the world. And they're not really doing a whole lot to actually fix that because they've got huge populations that they have to feed. And so, you know, overpopulation, it is a contributor to environmental problems. And, you know, the left, they sort of admit this, but at the same time, they're telling Western countries that already have a birth rate below replacement rate, hey, stop having kids. But then when it comes to Africa and South America and the Middle East and, you know, places like China and India that have a much higher population density, you know, places like Africa and the Middle East that have a much higher birth rate, well, there they just want us to send free food and medical care and, you know, just let them reproduce as much as they want. And if they get overpopulated, well, they can send their people here to replace us because we're not having kids because they told us not to.
As far as the left's policies goes, do you think their goal is to actually protect the environment, or are they just enacting their own goals that go beyond that?
I think a lot of it, like when you look at the Green New Deal, there's a lot of stuff in there that seems to have more to do with enacting global socialism and, you know, something approaching communism. A lot more stuff that has to do with that than stuff that would actually improve our environmental situation. They don't really have a whole lot of respect for the people who are actually going to be doing most of the work of saving the environment. So when you look at like the kinds of jobs that need to be done in order to save the environment, well, you need people that, you know, you need like wind turbine construction workers who are more than 97% male and mostly live in rural communities. They hate rural men. You need farmers to do tree farming to, you know, graze cattle on open land. And that kind of agriculture, you know, sustainable agriculture takes a lot more labor than factory farming does. So we really need to revitalize rural communities and have more people move to rural communities to do that kind of work if we want to do agriculture more sustainably than we're doing it now. It also takes a lot more labor to produce the same amount of energy from wind power and from solar power than to produce that same amount of energy from like coal or oil or natural gas. So if you want to use wind and solar power to replace some of our reliance on fossil fuels, you're going to need more people doing those jobs. And the left, you know, they look down on construction workers, they look down on farmers, they look down on the rural working class Americans who they're expecting to do all these jobs, and they're asking them to work harder for less in order to save the environment, while at the same time, you know, not acknowledging any of their needs. In many ways, they're asking them to work harder for less in other ways, like, you know, with welfare programs, food stamps, Section 8, you know, they're providing free food and shelter to people who don't work, while at the same time telling farmers and construction workers, hey, you need to work harder for less, not just to take care of them, but also to save the environment. So they're asking them to work harder for less on multiple different levels and offering no kind of compromise that is in any way going to appeal to the rural working class men who are going to be doing nearly all of the work.
And when you refer to the left, are you talking about leftists or neoliberals or woke capital?
Definitely referring to, like, the progressive left, the mainstream and establishment left, the sort of like social welfare status and democratic socialists. You know, not necessarily every faction of the left, but basically most of the mainstream left, and even a good deal of like the, you know, the further like progressive and communist and socialist left, I would include in that as well.
With the right in its current form, what would be described as mainstream conservatism, they're generally very dismissive of environmentalism as a leftist scheme, and they often neglect a lot of these legitimate threats to the environment. You're talking about, use the term new right and the new right. I mean, that's very different than American conservatism, if you refer to that. Basically, the American conservatism movement is generally very dismissive of environmentalism.
Yeah, and that's definitely a fair criticism. Certainly when you look at like the corporate establishment right, the neoconservative right, you know, they basically don't want to admit that there are any environmental problems, and they pretty much just look at like criticizing you know, the failures of the climate change people, but completely ignore deforestation, completely ignore wildlife loss, completely ignore, you know, the problems that agriculture causes in terms of like soil erosion and groundwater loss and all that sort of thing. So there's definitely a lot of like the establishment mainstream right that definitely ignores that. I'd say like we've definitely got a better chance at getting environmental issues to take root in, like, the Trump right and sort of the people to the right of him.
No, you're not talking on Trump. Specifically, you're talking about a lot of the movement that initially supported him, but Trump hasn't really been that great on environmentalism. He has, like, loosened a lot of protections for federal wildlife areas and in different wildlife protection laws.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he's kind of sold out to a lot of the establishment right on a lot of things, just, you know, because he can't really get things done without political allies, and unfortunately, you know, they still have a lot of control over the Republican Party. And I'm not sure that Trump himself specifically is particularly worried about the environment himself. But definitely when you look at, you know, the sort of the alt-right movement, not just like the alt-right specifically, but even the broader movement, but even like the specific alt-right people like Richard Spencer or the Traditionalist Worker Party people, who I guess they've kind of fallen apart, but like, you know, a lot of them said, you know, we'd be open to environmentalism. There's even a group called the Cascade Legion, I think, who are sort of like eco-fascist, basically. And, you know, none of those movements are necessarily huge or anything yet. But there definitely is sort of a vein of thought within the alt-right that, you know, protecting our nation and protecting our homelands, that includes protecting nature. That includes, you know, protecting the natural world that our ancestors lived in and evolved in. So there's definitely a vein of that running through, you know, the modern far right. The question is whether or not we can find a way to take that and make it more appealing to more of like the grassroots right. And I think, you know, taking this and framing it in a way that that tells rural working class men that, hey, this is your chance to be a hero. This is your chance to save the world. And instead of just, you know, constantly shitting all over you like the left-wing media does, you know, constantly making fun of the rural right-wing men who are going to be doing most of this work and calling them, you know, inbred hicks and whatever else they call them, maybe we should give them a narrative that says, hey, we're the heroes, we're the champions, we're going to save the world from the problems that, you know, those left-wing consumer culture people in the cities are causing. Giving them that narrative so that they can take pride in what they're doing, so that they can use that as sort of a bargaining chip to say, well, look, you need us to solve these problems. Maybe you should give us something in return. I think if we can present it that way, there's a good portion of the grassroots right who I think would be, you know, pretty interested in that and who it could catch on with.
To what degree is the destruction of wildlife and mass extinction caused by climate change? Do you have access to the statistics and data? I know there's issues brought up like the destruction of coral reefs caused by the acidic levels in the oceans, melting ice caps in the Arctic regions.
Yeah, the World Wildlife Fund has actually put together sort of a meta-study looking at a lot of evidence. Like, they've put together like tens of thousands of sources that they looked at, and what they found is that climate change from carbon emissions is responsible for less than 10% of wildlife loss. So the biggest sources of wildlife loss are things like habitat destruction, habitat degradation, hunting and poaching, and you know, other forms of pollution. So, like, land clearing for agriculture, that's just about the biggest cause of wildlife loss and habitat destruction. So, you know, climate change and carbon emissions relative to things like agriculture and, you know, clearing space for cities, you know, pollution for mining and stuff like that, really, carbon emissions themselves aren't that big of a deal relative to those issues.
Many on the left, they blame most of the world's ecological problems on the West, from economic exploitation to imperialism. Do you have a breakdown? We did touch upon this with the plastic going into the ocean, but do you have an overall breakdown on to what degree that leftist argument is accurate?
As far as like Western imperialism, I mean, they do have a little bit of a point that, you know, we do import stuff from China, and some of that, you know, some of the production of that does cause some pollution. But relative to the amount of destruction caused by, you know, feeding and sheltering and providing for their own people, we're definitely not contributing anywhere as much to the destruction of China's ecosystem as the Chinese people themselves are. And the same goes for most of the rest of the world. I don't necessarily have like hard numbers on that, but you can, what you can do, there's estimates out there of basically how much land it takes to provide for the needs of each person in a particular country. And you can then, you can take those numbers and then kind of look at them relative to population density and see that a country like China that has, you know, four times as much population density as we do, they have like almost 1.5 billion people packed into about the same amount of space that we have 300 and something million people in. So even if they're consuming, you know, a little less than half as much per person as we do, the fact that they have four times as many people in the same amount of space means that the amount of damage that they're doing per square mile of land is a lot more than ours. And those estimates are all kind of overestimating the impact of carbon emissions relative to wildlife loss and, you know, deforestation. So if you weight those a little bit differently and, you know, put them all in their proper context, it actually turns out the average Chinese person is doing a lot closer to the same amount of environmental damage that the U.S. is. And so then once you adjust for the fact that they're also overpopulated, you know, there's a reason why China's rivers are basically a toxic wasteland. There's a reason why they're dumping so much trash into the ocean. The reason why we're seeing all kinds of diseases coming from China, because they really have a filthy ecosystem, and then they eat their wildlife and get sick from it.
With the whole, like, the current coronavirus pandemic, would you say that the origins of that are an ecological issue?
There's certainly a possibility that, you know, some kind of contaminant contributed to that. I'm not going to say, you know, absolutely for certain that that it was something like that, but definitely, you know, when you have a dirty ecosystem that makes it easier for bacteria and viruses to thrive, and then you're going out and, you know, eating raw wildlife, definitely there's a risk there. And, you know, we've seen not just corona, we've seen, you know, SARS and quite a lot of other diseases coming out of China. It seems like they have an epidemic about every 2 or 3 years that ends up getting spread to the rest of the world. And I do think some of that has to do with how filthy their ecosystem is relative to the rest of the world.
And as far as addressing the whole angle of the economic exploitation of natural resources by global capitalism, that can be addressed by more nationalist policies such as protectionism and tariffs.
Sure. And actually, one good thing that Trump has been at least talking a good game on, not necessarily doing as much as he should, but you know, the sort of trade war that he's had with China over the last couple of years, you know, where he's trying to bring more manufacturing back to the U.S., where we, even if he's loosening the restrictions a little bit, they're still a lot better than the restrictions in China. So the more manufacturing we're doing here, the cleaner it's being done. And also, you know, when it comes to the spread of disease, the less stuff we're importing from China, the less likely we are to be pulling in, you know, whatever their new pandemic outbreak ends up being every few years. And that goes for, you know, production all over the world. You know, if we're looking at a third world country that has basically no restrictions on pollution, and, you know, big corporate interests are moving their production there because they can get away with things that they can't get away with in the U.S., that's a bad thing. And to an extent, the left has a point on that. But at the same time, the left isn't trying to bring jobs back to the U.S. in the same way that, like, the populist right wants to. Because that was the big issue, one of the big issues that Trump ran on and got elected on, was that he wanted to bring more jobs back from the U.S. He wanted to stop outsourcing to countries that don't have the same kinds of environmental regulations that we do. He didn't really push the environmental angle on it as much, but he did push it from like a trade war perspective. And even if he's not necessarily focusing on the environment, the results that he's producing by bringing more of those jobs back to the U.S. and not doing them overseas are still better than most of what the left has proposed.
You touched upon the overpopulation issue, and especially places like Sub-Saharan Africa, which are, they could grow, expected to grow those productions, the population could grow to 4 billion, and humanitarian medical aid and food aid does play a role in that, but the thing is, just cutting off all that aid, that could lead to a humanitarian crisis. So what do you propose? Like, would you propose promoting more birth control and family planning?
I think promoting birth control would be a good idea. The thing is, I'm not sure that their population is really going to take to that very well. They don't always trust the West very much as it is. They don't necessarily have as good an education system as we do, so it's not as easy to just say, you know, you need to plan your family out better, you need to limit how many kids you have. I don't think they're going to really take us up on that as much as we might like to think that they would. I'm not saying it's a bad idea to push that, but at the same time, you know, if you're looking at the possible consequences from a humanitarian standpoint of cutting off aid now versus the possible, you know, consequences of letting their population continue to grow until they basically completely collapse their ecosystem because they have too many people consuming and they're not doing enough to make sure that they're producing the stuff they consume sustainably, and especially like the contribution that hunting and poaching cause to, you know, to wildlife loss and species extinction is a lot bigger in Africa than it is in a lot of other places, because you do have a lot of people who just go out and hunt wildlife, and when you've got a rapidly growing population and, you know, not a rapidly growing wildlife population, the number of people going out and doing that and hunting for food greatly exceeds the supply of food, so then you do end up with a lot more species going extinct because of that. And so I think the threat that's posed by the possibility of them causing an ecological collapse and, you know, destroying their ecosystem to the point that it can't sustain anywhere near as many people, in a lot of ways, that's a much bigger risk than the relatively minor humanitarian crisis that we would have now by cutting off a lot of the aid that we give them.
As far as Western countries go involving Europeans in America, what are your thoughts on the message from the left that whites should have fewer kids to save the environment? They don't always, I mean, don't explicitly say that, but that there has been a lot of articles promoting that in, like, the Guardian in the UK, for instance.
Yeah, in some cases they do basically explicitly say that. There was a segment on Bill Nye's show where he had, like, a bioethicist on who basically said that, you know, two American kids are doing way more damage to the environment than seven Nigerian kids. But even if that was true, which it's not really, it's still only true if those seven people stay in Africa. If they, you know, if two of them come here and start consuming like the average American, even if they're right about, you know, how much damage the average American or Nigerian doing, as soon as you open the borders and let them come here, well, your whole argument just went away.
Yeah, they do make the case, those same individuals and media outlets, they do advocate mass immigration, and their response is always that we should deal with this on a global level, but the thing is, if immigrants come here, they dramatically increase their ecological footprint.
Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, like, they're not necessarily doing the jobs that that we need done in order to fix that. Like, how many poorly educated immigrants does it take to run a nuclear power plant so that you can, you know, replace fossil fuels with nuclear energy? Well, obviously, you're not going to have your poorly educated immigrants working at a nuclear power plant. You need people who were born in a country with a much better education system, and particularly, like, the higher IQ and more intelligent people from that that population need to be the ones having kids. And unfortunately, we don't really have a system that encourages that. In fact, like, if you're a woman, for every extra 15 IQ points you have, your odds of having kids drops by like 20%. And it's not quite as bad for men, but as you get into the higher IQs for men, your odds of having kids do start to go down as well. So that's the problem. Is it's generally the more intelligent people in our society who are reading those those calls to have fewer kids, and so the people who are the most capable of doing complicated jobs like wind turbine maintenance, like running nuclear power plants, planning out a sustainable farm. You know, it's a lot more complicated to plan a sustainable farm than to do factory farming. It's a lot more complicated to do nuclear power or wind power than it is to do fossil fuels. So you do need a little bit more intelligent and more educated workforce for that. And it seems like those are the first people to cut off their birth rate. And we need exactly the opposite. We need them to be having more kids, but we need to find a way to, you know, sort of convince the less intelligent and less educated people in society to have fewer. Although, you know, in some ways, when you look at, like, the rural working class, they're not necessarily the most educated people in our country, but relative to people from other countries, they are definitely more educated, and a lot of them can handle things like electrical work to do, you know, wind turbine maintenance. A lot of farmers do have, you know, a degree in agriculture. So, you know, even that level of education, it's good enough, and it's better than what we can import from the third world. So I think in some ways we would be better off, you know, raising our birth rate at least to replacement levels. We don't necessarily have to go much above replacement levels.
If everyone had five kids, there could be a danger of overpopulation and ecological harm. The ideal scenario would be a dramatic reduction in immigration levels combined with like a native fertility of maybe slightly above replacement level.
Yeah, because like when we're having like 1.7 or 8 or so kids per couple, which is about what American whites have, you know, that's not enough to produce the next generation of workers that we need.
Something like 2.4.
Yeah, 2.3, 2.4, 2.5, somewhere around there would be good.
So with the current agricultural model of factory farming, corporate agriculture, it depends upon a much larger underclass. And a lot of these agricultural regions, like the Central Valley of California, and I'm sure a lot of places in the Deep South, have some of the worst poverty in the nation. Would the agricultural reform that you're proposing build up like a much stronger, high-skilled workforce and a much larger middle class?
I think it would help. Because, as I said, sustainable agriculture is a little bit more complicated. So you do have to pay a little bit more for it than you do for factory farming. And also, you know, wind turbine maintenance and solar power, you know, you do have to pay more for those because they are more complicated than, you know, being a coal miner. So I do think it would raise the income level in rural communities a little bit, and it would make more opportunities for the more educated people in those communities. So instead of, you know, these days it seems like the most educated people in those communities tend to run to the cities. We need to send some of the better educated people from the cities back to those communities to do the more complicated jobs. And I think that, you know, it would kind of eliminate the need for the low-skilled workers and replace it with a need for better educated workers. At the same time, though, that is going to drive up food prices, that is going to drive up energy prices. So, you know, it is kind of a double-edged sword in that sort of sense. But at the same time, you know, maybe that means that we don't really need, you know, a welfare-dependent immigrant class, which we do see a lot of immigrants come in, and, you know, the illegal ones often do, you know, sign up for welfare, often illegally.
A lot of that low-skilled agricultural jobs, they could be automated in the future.
Some of them could be. At the same time, automation in agriculture is kind of, you know, what gave us factory farming and what gave us some of our current problems, so I'm a little skeptical about just how much automation can actually do in terms of keeping agriculture and energy production sustainable, because it seems like building a wind turbine and having to build them, you know, a few miles apart, that's not a process that can really easily be automated. And the same thing with like sustainable farming, where you're having to grow multiple different kinds of crops, you know, on the same field, as opposed to monocrop agriculture, where you're just, you know, one densely packed crop. It's a little bit harder to use machines to do that when you have, you know, all these different kinds of crops spaced out, you know, across the same field. Whereas if it's all one crop, you can generally do a lot more of that with machines. So unfortunately, automation, you know, it'd be nice if we lived in the Andrew Yang universe where automation could solve all of our problems. But
so you're not on board with fully automated luxury communism?
No, I think that's a pretty unrealistic goal. Maybe in a couple hundred years, but I don't think with our environmental situation that we're really in a position where we could do that. And unfortunately, communism, like one of the things you need for it is you almost have to be post-scarcity before communism can really be a viable system. Right now, with the way our ecological carrying capacity is going, like ecological space is a scarce resource, and it's something that we have to take more steps to protect. And I don't think that we can just take the communist attitude of giving to everyone according to their needs at a time when trying to provide for people is destroying our ecosystem. We have to insist that people put the effort in to help us produce things sustainably if they want more back from society.
What do you think about urban agriculture and vertical farming?
I think it's definitely a good idea, and certainly the people that want to make city living more sustainable should definitely be working on that more. I'm not sure just how much it's going to do to to replace the need for rural agriculture, but I would definitely like to see us put a little bit more effort and research into seeing what we can do to make that a thing.
What types of energy sources would you like to see? Obviously, fossil fuels are not sustainable. Do you see wind and solar as viable, or do you think we should invest more in nuclear?
I think we should expand wind and solar somewhat, but unfortunately, there is a limit to how much of our energy we can provide from wind and solar, partly because they're not the most consistently reliable power source, because like, obviously with solar energy, you get a lot of power during the day. You don't get any at night, and it's hard to like store electricity on the scale that we use it, for cities. So you kind of do have to have like an alternate power source that you can run overnight when your solar power plants aren't getting anything, and that you can run on windy days or on non-windy days when your wind turbines aren't getting any energy. So I do think that we are going to have to use some nuclear. At the same time, nuclear energy, it's not as bad, at least as the, the climate change people say, in terms of its environmental impact, but it does have some risk. So you look at like Fukushima and how that polluted the Pacific Ocean. You look at Chernobyl and, how that left the area around Chernobyl irradiated. You look at the need to dispose of nuclear waste, and we are getting better at making power plants, making nuclear power plants safer. We are getting better at reducing the amount of waste that they produce, but they're not risk-free. So we do have to be honest about that and, kind of weigh the risk of that against, the problems of each of our other energy sources. So I don't think we should have an economy that's based, just on any one energy source. We're going to have to diversify somewhat, and we're going to have to make sure that renewable energy and nuclear energy are part of that diversified energy portfolio.
How much of a problem is an economic model that's based on consumption? I do remember a while back it was George Bush said it was like your patriotic duty to consume to get the economy going. Trump has said similar stuff, but it is a problem that the reality is our economic model is based on consumption, and there are sort of alternatives to that that's put out, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of both a left and a right talking point, and it's definitely a big part of like Keynesian economics, which I'm not a huge fan of. But I think solving our ecological problems, like, you're going to have to move past that economic model, because the model of putting consumption first, consumption is ultimately what's driving our ecological problems right now. The biggest contributor to wildlife loss and deforestation is food production. Everyone consumes food. Everyone's contributing to that problem. Fossil fuels contribute more problems than just carbon emissions. Anyone who drives their car is contributing to that problem. So the more we consume, the more damage we end up doing to our economy. So I think we're going to have to move to an economy that's more focused on the production side of things and on making sure that we are rewarding people for doing production sustainably and, make sure that we're rewarding people based on, if they're helping clean up ocean trash, if they're helping, run tree farms to kind of help reverse deforestation. We're going to have the kind of economy that gives those people the rewards that they deserve, and then looks at the urban consumers who do, less necessary jobs, who aren't working in agriculture, who aren't working in, construction and infrastructure and energy, and say, maybe the call center worker is not as important as the guy who's building our wind turbines. Maybe we need more people doing, these actual production jobs, and not so many people just, working a make-work job just so that they can get paid and go consume. Maybe we need to reconsider our welfare state that gives people free stuff so that they can consume and get the market going, and instead say, if you want to consume, you have to help us produce, and you have to help us produce sustainably. Because if we don't do that, and our ecosystem continues to degrade, eventually there's not going to be anything to consume. Eventually, we're not going to be able to survive.
Ideally, how would the economy determine profits? Would it be based on how much business contributes to the public good, the customer's quality of life?
Yeah, I mean, the ideal goal in any, you know, any proper economic system is to try and make it as meritocratic as possible. So the more you contribute to society's well-being, the more you get back from society. And I think we really need to get back to that. Another ideal is reciprocity, which, if you're familiar with, I don't know if you've read like Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, but like reciprocity is basically the most stable evolutionary strategy. And that means, you know, whatever someone does for you, you have to repay them. So if someone is, you know, doing good things for your survival, you should be contributing to their survival too. If someone is, you know, a drain on your survival, you can sort of, you know, you can give them a chance for so long, but at some point, if they're consistently bad for your survival, you eventually have to cut them off. And so we need an economic system that's based on reciprocity. We need an economic system that says, oh, you're helping feed people and you're helping do it sustainably. Okay, you're more valuable and we're going to take better care of you because of it. And we need an economic system that says, you know, maybe we'll give you a little bit of help at first to help you get back on your feet, but if you continue to take advantage of the system, we're going to have to cut you off at some point. And we need a system that follows that evolutionary law if we want to survive as a species. I mean, evolution's been the law for 4 billion years. It's not something that we can just overturn. It's something that we have to obey, whether we like it or not.
Do you have any thoughts on urban planning models? Obviously, suburban sprawl is totally unsustainable. There is this like urbanism and vertical living in cities, the push to retrofit suburbia into more walkable communities, and then there's also what to do with declining rural areas, areas where small towns have become deserted, and where there's just nothing but factory farms. So basically like living models in both the cities, suburbs, and rural areas.
Yeah, I'm definitely more interested in like helping revitalize our rural communities. At the same time, there are definitely things we can do to make the cities better. You know, the vertical agriculture that you were talking about was a good step. If we're going to have suburbs, I think, you know, the focus that everyone has now on, you know, maintaining a nice lawn, that's terrible. Like, you waste so many resources on your lawn and it produces nothing. What we should be telling people to do is grow a home garden, produce some of your own food yourself, use the land around, you know, the land that you're going to be living on anyway. If you're going to have a house with a yard, put some, you know, put some grapevines up the back fence. You know, have an apple tree in the yard. Have something that's going to produce some kind of food for your family, so at least that land isn't just, you know, completely going to waste. And people used to do that. You know, back in the 50s, people would have a home garden. They'd grow tomatoes and bell peppers. You know, they'd have an apple tree, a peach tree, something like that in the yard. And they'd produce, you know, it wouldn't be enough to feed their family entirely, but they'd at least, you know, a few times a year, they'd get a nice little bounty out of it. They'd make, you know, make food for them, their family and their friends. And it would at least put that space to use. And so I think we do need to encourage that, particularly in the suburbs where, you know, they're taking up a lot more space per person. If you're going to have that space, you might as well be doing something productive with it.
And all these ideas need to be put out as in a new right or third way, a Green New Deal. So with the ecological attributes aspects, but same with the proposed Green New Deal, it also has to be proposed as an economic New Deal, providing people jobs and an overall better quality of life.
Yeah, and I think it should be something with a bit of a focus on like revitalizing rural communities, on, you know, having a little bit more respect for the people who produce our food, the people who put energy into our homes. Because, you know, if you look at like the kinds of jobs that are needed for this, agriculture is the deadliest industry in America by deaths per hour worked. Construction is the deadliest industry in America in terms of total deaths. So the industries that we need more people working in order to fix these problems are some of the most difficult, dangerous, and dirty jobs out there. If you want to do tree farming to, you know, fix deforestation and pull carbon out of the atmosphere, tree farming is the single deadliest job in America. It's because you're not just planting the trees, you're also cutting them down to make room for new ones, and, you know, that part of the job, it is very dangerous and results in a lot of deaths. If you want to clean trash up from the oceans, it's very similar work to commercial fishing, which is the second deadliest job in the U.S. And so we have to have more respect for the kinds of workers who are willing to put their lives on the line and take risks in order to feed us, in order to shelter us, in order to put power in our outlets, and in order to clean up the places that we live. And I think the economy that we have now, you know, we respect people just for consuming. We respect people for playing the stock market and basically, you know, gambling on business and not really contributing a whole lot to society in the process. And we definitely need to reverse that model. We need to put more, you know, put more of an emphasis on respecting the people who make it possible for us to survive, and less of a, you know, less respect for people who are just existing and consuming and not really contributing anything back to society.
Your other article on UNS is how one-third of America's workers' pay is being stolen. Here's how. So you have these comparisons, the pay to productivity rates, based on a graph from the Economic Policy Institute. What are the overall rates, and how do they vary by class?
Yeah, that article, I get pretty deep into the data at the start of that one. But basically, what we saw historically was, like, from the sort of mid to late 1940s up until the early 1970s, the productivity of the average worker doubled and the pay of the average worker doubled. So worker pay went up at almost exactly the same rate as productivity. And then in the early 70s, worker pay basically stopped going up over the course of the 70s. It fell for most of the 80s, and then it's kind of slowly risen again since then. But the productivity of the average worker has about doubled again since the 1970s, and our pay is only up a little bit since then. So, let's see. Oh, and the Heritage Foundation, they kind of tried to, like, tear the study down, but one of the facts that came out in their attempt to tear down the Economic Policy Institute's analysis, they looked at each income group in the U.S. by, you know, how much their wages had gone up. And they found that the bottom 20% of workers, so that, you know, that underclass that you were talking about earlier, their pay actually went up at about the same rate as productivity. And the top 20% of workers, so, you know, your management, you know, your owner class sort of, as well as some very highly paid professionals, their pay went up by a lot more than productivity. But you look at the middle 60% of workers, you know, your middle class and the upper part of your lower working class, their pay went up a lot slower than productivity. So even the people who want to try and dismiss this problem admitted that for the middle class and a large, you know, the more skilled portion of the lower class, their pay has basically been stagnant since the early 1970s. Their pay hasn't gone up by anywhere near as much as it was supposed to have. So we have a really broad swath of middle America who really are not getting paid what they should be getting paid for their work. And this ties in a lot to the more recent article I wrote, because the kinds of workers that we need doing the jobs that we need done to solve climate change are exactly the workers who are in that middle 60% whose pay has been getting screwed over.
And yeah, you see this overall decline in quality of life, and a lot of it has to do with, it's not just the wages. So there's, yeah, politicians will talk about raising the wages, but there's also raises to purchasing power. So there's a cost of healthcare, education, the cost of real estate.
Yeah. And, I mean, really, just look around America right now. Like, more than a third of our country is obese. I mean, we're the most educated, you know, most productive group of workers basically in the entire history of the world. And, like, over a third of us are overweight because the only things we can afford to eat are cheap, overprocessed garbage. Why do we live like that? Why does the most capable workforce in the entire history of humanity live like that? We should have a better quality of life right now. We can afford to make a better quality of life right now. But we have an economy that's broken and doesn't do that.
The left's argument of a lot of these problems, they'll point out to the decline in unionization, corporate greed, tax cuts for the rich.
Yeah, so as far as unionization specifically, union membership has been declining since the early 1950s. So we had like two decades of solid wage growth while union membership was declining before we actually saw any kind of decline in worker pay. So, you know, like, there's no real correlation that we can see between union membership and worker pay. As far as corporate greed, I mean, businesses were always greedy. Businesses were greedy in the 40s, 50s, and 60s when worker pay was going up. It's not that businesses being greedy changed. It's that the way that businesses are able to kind of take advantage of the economy changed. And that gets into some economic history of things that changed in the early 1970s. So from just before the end of World War II up until 1971, we had a policy in place called Bretton Woods. And it certainly wasn't a perfect policy, but it was basically this international monetary agreement that tied the U.S. dollar and most of the world's major currencies to the price of gold, which meant that you couldn't really, you couldn't inflate your currency enough to change the value of it. And once we got rid of that, banks were able to, create a whole lot more money. The Federal Reserve was able to create a whole lot more money. And the process of doing that specifically enriches the banker class. It specifically enriches, the member banks of the Federal Reserve. It specifically enriches the investment bankers who are buying government bonds. So there's a lot of mechanisms that they have to sort of make money off of the creation of money. And if you're making money off the creation of money and you're not actually producing anything and contributing it into the economy, you're basically just stealing from everybody, because you're getting money you can spend to take things that everyone else produced, but you're not producing anything that they can get back from you. And so once that policy changed, like, the next year, from 1972 to 1975, worker pay fell every year. It then went back up just a little bit, but it was still basically stagnant, basically ever since then. And the best year that we've had for worker pay growth since then was 2008 to 2009, when the rich lost a lot of money in the housing market crash.
So obviously the supply of labor has increased from mass immigration and women entering the workforce, and now there's a whole issue of automation. But you would actually say that monetary policy and the overall financialization of the economy is a much bigger factor than supply of labor.
Definitely. I'm not a huge immigration advocate, obviously. I think, it has a risk to our ecosystem. But I think that's a much better argument against mass immigration than the idea that it's keeping wages down. I think the economic changes we need to make to save our ecosystem are going to make the sort of underclass, poorly skilled workers more or less obsolete. But as far as the effect that immigration has on wages, we saw rising productivity consistently, even as we were bringing immigrant workers into the country, because the more educated portion of our workers had their productivity go up so much more than that. And yet, they got nothing in return for it. You can look at a graph of how many immigrants were coming in, versus how much it was affecting our wages. And there's not much more of a correlation there than there is between union membership and wages. As far as women entering the workforce, that really ramped up from the 70s onward as you had second wave feminism. And in a lot of ways, that was more of a response to the fact that men's wages weren't going up anymore.
That's a good point, because a lot of right-wingers, they'll say that women working is part of a feminist conspiracy, but the thing is, under the current economic model, basically if you have a couple with kids, basically women are forced to work under the current economic model.
Yeah, because men's work no longer pays what it should, and so, I know a lot of women who honestly would rather be a mom and housewife, but they don't have that option. Like, there aren't enough men who make enough money to pay them to stay at home, so they're like, well, I have to get a job. And you look at, the degrees that women go for when they go to college, I know a lot of women who went for teaching degrees, who went for child psychology degrees, who basically got degrees in how to raise children, and yet they can't afford to have their own children. Instead, they're having to work to pay off, the massive amount of debt that they got to learn how to raise other people's kids. And it's just an absurd economy that we have that, our most educated and most intelligent people, the women are all getting degrees that then saddle them with debt, and the degrees they're getting are to raise kids, which is what they really want to do. And it's an important part of life. I mean, reproduction has been the most important act of evolutionary survival for 4 billion years. It's not like women having kids is just, some unimportant thing that we do to keep them out of the way. It's the single most important act of survival. And yet our most intelligent women can't afford to do it because they're saddled with all the student aid debt. And it's just ridiculous. But because we have the kind of economy where men don't make as much money as they should for their work, you know, a couple that thinks they should have a certain standard of living based on, you know, how capable they are, how much they contribute to society, in order to get that standard of living, you have to have both parents working. In order to get the quality of life where you feel comfortable bringing a child in, you have to have both parents working, and then they don't have the time to raise a kid, and by the time they're done paying off their student loans, they can barely afford, you know, they're getting old enough, they don't have time to have that many kids.
As far as this whole issue of wage garnishing, what economic solutions do you propose, and what is a big part of it, is usury as well?
Definitely usury is a part of it. In fact, like the creation of debt is a big part of the process that banks use.
Yeah, mortgages on homes, or credit card debt, student loan debt.
Yeah, and all of those things grew massively since the 70s. In fact, there was one study that I cite in the article. From the 1940s up until the early 1970s, GDP growth was the biggest indicator of how much the stock market would change. Since the early 1970s, GDP growth hasn't really had much of a relationship with stock market growth. It's all been based on debt and on Federal Reserve policy. Those have been the biggest drivers of stock market growth. So usury is definitely a big part of it. And sorry, what was the rest of your question?
Yeah, and what economic solutions would you propose, or monetary policy reforms?
Yeah, well, we definitely need to get rid of fractional reserve banking. We definitely need to stop, you know, bailing out the bankers every time something goes wrong. And we need to, at the very least, go back to the, you know, the sort of Bretton Woods era of tying the dollar's value to something more concrete. It doesn't necessarily have to be gold, but gold is something that worked for a good portion of human history. So it's not, you know, it's not like it doesn't have a track record that we can look at. And Bretton Woods did work for, you know, it did work out for workers during the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So I could see us going back to something like that. But one way or another, we have to rein in the banks. We have to prevent them from just, you know, printing money and giving themselves free stuff, basically. You know, we have to go back to a stable currency where they don't have the ability to do that.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the show. Paul, is there anything you'd like to add about any of these topics or to those two articles?
No, hopefully I'll have some more articles for UNS later. The only other thing I want to plug is I wrote a book called Sionism, P-S-I-O-N-I-S-M. You can get a copy of it on Amazon, e-reader copy. I wrote this like probably 6 or 7 years ago, like before you know, the Trump movement happened, but it's basically about a dystopian future where there's a one world government trying to force everybody to be the same, and you've got this group of different like national and religious separatists, as well as you know, some more like left-wing and pro-technology people whose lifestyles are also being oppressed by the government, who've all kind of joined together to fight them, and a group of them develop psionic powers and use those to fight the government. So I think a lot of your readers would find that book pretty interesting.
So it's about this trend towards homogenization, like a global monoculture, because right-wingers will often complain, like it's conservative talking points, that multiculturalism leads to a more divided society. But I just see that more as a temporary stage. I see more of the trend towards towards kind of like a mass homogenization, one monoculture, and under like multinational corporations.
Yeah, and it's sort of a, you know, a conflict between actual diversity, where you have different kinds of people behaving differently, and, you know, people in different places are allowed to do different things, versus a monoculture that's imposed on everyone to try and force everyone into equality.
And ironically, a lot of the really insane woke stuff, like identity politics, ironically, that could backfire against neoliberalism and lead to like more like neo-tribalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it honestly can, and you know, you're kind of seeing that play itself out in America today. Definitely it played itself out on the streets quite a bit in 2016 and 17 when we had, you know, Antifa and you know, some of the right-wing groups fighting, you know, fighting openly in the streets, and I guess it's still happening in some places like Seattle and Portland these days. Well, maybe not now with the quarantines, but it was certainly happening as recently as like last year. So, yeah, it really does seem to be causing a lot of conflict. You also can look at like the, you know, the Muslim sex slave grooming gangs in Europe. You know, I don't want to get all the way into that, especially for already almost at the end of the show. But yeah, it definitely can cause a lot of resentment from different groups, you know, against each other instead of bringing a unified culture. But at the same time, you don't necessarily want to destroy that diversity. You just want to give each different group their own space that they can do their own thing in. And that tends to make people a lot happier than trying to force a whole bunch of very different people to share the same space and the same set of rules.
Yeah, I've kind of heard that concept been referred to as right-wing multiculturalism. So traditionally the right has been more obsessed with like one, that there's sort of one monolithic American identity, whether it's sort of the past, the paleoconservatives will think of more of an Anglo-Protestant society from the 1950s or prior to that, and then more kind of normie conservatives will talk about colorblind civic nationalism based on free markets like Turning Point USA. I think the way to go is more like a kind of a right-wing multiculturalism, where you look at how some of these ethnic enclaves have been successful, and for European Americans and basically where all groups could emulate the successes of that.
Yeah, and you're even seeing some of that on like the social justice left, where you have, you know, all these different groups, you know, the Black Lives Matter people, the, you know, Hispanic Lives Matter people, the LGBT people, where they each have their, you know, pet issues that separate themselves, you know, them from the society at large, and they want their own spaces. They want their own, you know, whether they call them safe spaces or whatever else. So you've already kind of got that on the left, where they're starting to reject the idea that we all need to be one homogenous culture, and they're all sort of trying to break off into their own groups. They're just doing it very, very differently than, you know, the right. Not even necessarily super differently, just like using totally different language and, you know, approaching it from a totally different angle, more so than actually wanting different results. And so I think there is kind of room for a compromise of moving in a different direction that gives everyone their own space and makes those portions of the left and right happy. But the left and right wing establishment are so in lockstep on, you know, having a unified country that imposes the exact same standards on everyone, that you kind of have all these different fringes, you know, that each have their own issue, who are all against, you know, the central establishment for completely, totally different reasons. And that's sort of one of the themes of Zionism. So I feel a little bit prophetic having written that a few years ago and seeing the way that the world's gone since then. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Paul Tripp, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Robert. It's been great, and I look forward to hearing more of your shows.